The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
The Round Golf Podcast with Richard Kaufman.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Round Golf Podcast. Hope you're enjoying the series so far. We've had a lot of big names, a lot of great response and reaction from you as well. But there's a little bit of me that maybe thinks, you know, I sold out a little in this series because, you know, in series one, and the whole point of doing this series was about bringing you some amazing stories, maybe from some people that you don't know that much about. And of course, to attract many of you to listen, I thought, well, maybe I need to get some so-called bigger names as well along. And we've heard from the likes of Padraig Harrington, heard from the likes of Gary Player, Danny Willett, Kari Webb, major winners, great champions. And believe you me, it's been a real pleasure for me to do them too. But what about the lesser-known stories? And this episode that you're going to listen to now from John Morgan, or John E. Morgan, as of course he's known in terms of golfing world, is maybe a little bit getting back to what that first series was about. Now, this is an incredible story. It's a little longer than the usual podcast that I brought you in this series, but I didn't feel like anything should really be left out. The twists and turns along the way. I mean, if you don't know the story of John, just as a little teaser, we start on dyslexia, we move to epilepsy, we talk about him going from Euro Pro Tour to Challenge Tour to European Tour to PGA Tour, all in the matter of months. I mean, it's an incredible step-by-step look at his life, his career, and obviously, which has led him in the end to the fairways, talking with a microphone in his hand as well. It really is an amazing tale. I think you're really going to enjoy it with John's unique personality coming to the fore as well. Here it is. So John, normally when I do these interviews, I've started with the round.
Yeah.
And you've chosen your round.
Mm.
But do you mind if I kind of do this in chronological order?
If I understood what that meant, I would say yes anyway. So I'll say yes anyway, whatever it means.
So in order from the day you were born to where we are right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, of course, mate. Of course.
So growing up near Bristol, you're from Portishead?
Born and bred, yeah. Half-breed between Shirehampton and Hartcliffe.
And it's fair to say, from not, I suppose, certainly in England, but maybe around the world, not your typical golfing family.
No, you got this kind of palaver that, you know, golf is a rich man's game. My family was definitely far from it. And being a docker's son, lucky for me, Shirehampton welcomed me with open arms, being a very Dockers community kind of spirit down there on the dock wall at the Bridge of Avonmouth coming in. My dad got me in at the age of 9 and I got the bug.
Yeah, and you were a golf-obsessed kid, I think, from what
I was obsessed with anything sport. Anything sport, football, rugby, cricket. I wasn't a bad cricketer. I fancied my hand at cricket. But, I remember one day my dad just said to me, which one do you prefer? I said, Dad, I like golf. He said, do you want to take it a little, you know, play it a little bit more often? I said, love to. Yeah, and that was it.
I don't know if this is right. At school, there was a teacher who wasn't that pleasant to you. And one of the things that he was annoyed with you about was that you kept on going on about golf.
Yeah, I mean, any excuses, really. I mean, it's all I lived and breathed. I wasn't academically clever, you know, 2 2 is 4. You know, I sometimes get that wrong. But spelling was a nightmare for me. Dyslexia kicked in, found that pretty late on in school life. So, you know, being picked on or whatever at school was, you know, quite normal for me.
So you're growing up in the era of, say, the 1980s?
Yeah, 88 when I first went to the big school, yeah.
So in those days, something like dyslexia wasn't commonly known. So,
yeah,
as you say, people were picking on you for getting things wrong.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just get it totally back to front. Like, you know, you do a sentence and words would be switched over, a couple of, you know, letters would be switched over, yeah, and it just made you look a little bit foolish. And sometimes teacher would send you up to the front and make you write things on the board. And all of a sudden, people could see it for themselves, what, you know, how back to front my kind of writing was and how outrageous, you know, where you put a capital letter in the middle of a word where it's not supposed to be. It was like, just, I didn't know. I had no idea.
But this teacher that wasn't pleasant about you going on about golf, which just wasn't pleasant full stop, was he?
No, he just wasn't pleasant, but he just used to take the mickey. I think he just, you know, you had quite a powerful class. I was in the kind of the lower classes later on that were, you know, after grades came out and stuff like that, and they could tell you where you were kind of going. They put you in kind of a lower grade kind of class out of the group. And yeah, you know, you had some silly boys and girls in that group, but some real clever ones that were just, say, probably lazy, you know, didn't really put their effort in, but, you know, at the end of the day, you just like picking on someone that was a little bit weaker. I didn't like it at all. I mean, you know, result of, you know, got suspended from school, loads of effort cards. Effort cards, really, I think, they were down to me not being able to do the work, you know, not finding out about my dyslexia. I would say also report cards with me just trying to fix, you know, fix in with the local gang, you know, going around the back of the school huts and messing about, being naughty and setting off fire alarms after school. And, you know, it came home, actually. I remember Mr. Kendrick, he was the head of my class, and I set this fire alarm off, and it was because one of the kids said, press this. And I went, okay, and I pressed it, and the alarm went off. And they all came over and they all said, you're writing it now, John, you're done for. And I was like, just panicked, because I just thought mum and dad are going to absolutely hit 7 bells out of me. Well, they weren't like that, but you know what I mean? They're going to tell me off. And anyway, went up to the headmaster's office, crying my eyes out, just going, so sorry, sir, blah, 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 didn't mean to do it. Well, we got to suspend you, John. We understand this. We understand what's going on. So they knew, must have known something. How, you know, peer pressure of different people that were around me. And it never went down on a report afterwards, but I had to physically be away from the school for a day. But it was quite, I think I probably peed off a few kids and teachers because I did it right at the end of school break, you know, so when school was ended at 3:30, I'd hit the button and everybody had to come back and be counted for, you know, if they were at home or whatever. So yeah, I wasn't the most happiest chappy there.
And the reason for bringing this up and the reason for not going to the round is I think you've got the most incredible story. And to start with the round would just make it difficult to give the balance of where we are when we come to the round.
Yeah,
so was the dyslexia, and because of everything that's going on at school, did golf then become a real big escape for you?
Massive. I mean, all I had to do was add up cards, you know, add up a scorecard. I think that's why I got my handicap down so quickly, though, Rich. Adding it up wrong. But no, I think, it definitely was a escape route. As soon as 16 arrived and I was able to go out and work and I'd grab any odd job I could, you know, stacking shelves, you know, glass collecting at a pub or working in a steel factory, cutting corners on bits of steel, which I used to do, making filing cabinets, anything really, sweeping the floors, whatever it was. Anything just to get me to that golf course. But I had some great times as well. I was quite lucky with school, you know, coming through in the sense of it gave me the motivation I needed. I had a few teachers that were in my class as well that lived over near Clevedon Golf Club, where I eventually joined when I was like 11. And they would give me lifts all the way, you know, and that's like 5-6 miles, you know, down the road. They'd give me a lift all the way down there, or I'd have my little BMX. And I'd just travel with my BMX all the way down to the school. After school, I'd finish at like 3:30. My dad had finished work at like 5:30, 6 o'clock. Then he'd pick me up and put the bike in the back of the car and then bring me back home. It was just that addictive. Every day after school, I would cycle 5-6 miles to that golf course, not even hesitating. I just loved it. Absolutely loved it.
And your game was pretty good. I mean, you were really good even as an amateur, but again, I look at your England international career and it's, as an amateur, it's almost non-existent.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, I think the Southwest, unfortunately for the Southwest, I might get shot down for this, but I mean, we kind of got overlooked in a way. There were some serious talented golfers down in that neck of the woods. But, you know, you had the strength of Yorkshire and Surrey, and they had some almighty players. Almighty players. But we had some really good quality players ourselves down there. We had the likes of Simon McCarthy, Dave Dixon, myself, and then you had Philip Rowe, who was a star-studded, you know, it was a load of us down
but,
there.
But so are you saying then it was the area as opposed to maybe a class thing?
Yeah, I think, well, the expansion of the English Golf Union back then, you know, England's, you know, if you were Wales, Scotland or Ireland, no disrespect to them, but they were a smaller country compared to England, and I don't think England, with the kind of representatives, you know, to scouts or whatever to try and find a talent, were that widespread, if you know what I mean. They didn't go down that far. And I mean, there was a nice guy, Rodney Hare. He gave me my first shout. He was a Western Supermare chap. And he gave me the nod that I was going to be playing against France. And that was just a one-off. And luckily for me, another Somerset guy that I knew was actually the captain at the time. And that was Malcolm Lewis. So really and honestly, if it wasn't for two Somerset people that were in the loop, I wouldn't have ever sniffed an England spot. Even though I think I was good enough for it.
Well, some people take a little while to adjust from amateur to pro. I'm going to come on to the fact that you didn't take very long at all. But before that, am I right? Did you have your first epilepsy incident before you turned pro?
Yeah, it was in front of Dave Dixon. It was a funny story, actually. Dicko, I hope you don't mind me saying this. Yeah, he was dating a lovely girl called Louisa. I won't say her surname, but you know who she is. Yeah, round her parents' house, and we'd been out on the night on the town, having a good time. And they're a couple. So I'm sleeping at the bottom of the bed on the floor somewhere. We've had a good time. I got a little competition up the road at Embry, and it gets called off for some reason. So I've gone out the house and I've come back in. The mother's opened the door and I'm headed upstairs. I can hear him, you know, getting it on. I've just gone, hey, here we go. So for a laugh, I thought I'd just knock on the door and run in. You know, anyway, and then quickly run back out. I wasn't going to stay there. But anyway, this is how funny a situation it is, so Rich. You know, I mean, if you were a fly on the wall, you would definitely fall off absolutely legless. You'd pass out. Because I've gone in there, they're under the covers, having their way, and they quickly spread eagle, and I've jumped in the middle of them, and I'm laying on top of the covers while they're both naked under them. And I've gone straight into it then. So I've gone straight into a grand mal seizure while they were having nookie, and they're naked under the bed. So it's like I'm fully clothed, and they just said I bolted straight upright, was sick into my hands, and then I just flipped back and convulsed and more, and then started shaking all over. And I remember I bit off my tongue, so there was a lot of blood then. Yeah, I cracked a few ribs, and that was it. Just woke up in hospital, because I think I went on for a ridiculous amount of time that you shouldn't go on, I think, beyond, you know, your heart can pass, you know, give way or whatever. I think it's happened twice in my life, but that particular one, it went on a considerable long time, like 9-10 minutes, which is ridiculous. So for the body to keep shaking and going crazy.
And had you had any sign of anything like this before?
Maybe, Rick. The thing is, no, I don't think I had, but, you know, sometimes these partial seizures where you kind of just have your memory loss and you just lose your train of thought and you're a little bit lax and you forget what place you're in or who you're hanging around with, or, you know, you might be my best mate, Rich, and I look around at you or my brother and I go to you, who are you? I mean, it'd be pretty freaky, I'd imagine, but Dicko said I did that to him then. Where am I? And he said it's quite bizarre, especially when you know one another for such a long time. But yeah, that was the first and a big one at that. So it was like, hello world, this is epilepsy. So yeah.
How old were you?
Oh, I think I was about 18, 19 then, Rich. So somewhere around there. I can't really remember. I mean, the memory is shot to bits, really, through all of them. So.
Did you think, because at this time you're obviously thinking that you might have a career as a golfer?
Yeah.
So what did that mean?
Oh, nothing. It never stopped me. Never. Not even crossed my mind. I mean, the nice thing was I'm blessed with amazing parents and grandparents who are still alive then, totally backing me through the hill. Great members at my club that always had my corner, pushing me left, right and centre. They, for one, they would not have let me, you know, give it up either. You know, even though I might feel defeated or feel like this is going to hinder me. No, I had the luxury of great friends, great mum and dad, grandparents and people at the club, all my mates. So yeah, I was so lucky.
But you must have had to take medication after an incident like this. Did it affect your golf game at all?
Yeah, it did. I drastically put on weight. It was called Epilim, was the first drug. And yeah, it wasn't a good one, man. It was just lots of what can I say, headaches and migraines and nausea, just tired, lethargic, and I just ballooned out. I went like a balloon. And then all of a sudden, like some doctor said to me, who on a side near where I live, said, you shouldn't be on that drug. So I went back and then they whacked me on a new one. Yeah, it was crazy.
So how big a gap is there to the period of this incident, getting the control with the medication, to where you then decided you're going to be a professional golfer, turn pro?
I would say it took a good year, 2 years, to get my head around the drugs. My thinking definitely changed, because they are brain drugs, you know, that's what they do. So yeah, they're going to change your way of thought and your outlook and stuff, but luckily for me, my madness for the game and my passion for it never changed. So my creativity as a player, my flair, which I based my game on. I was never a structured kind of black and white guy, methodical guy. Everything was painted and rosy and loads of dragons flying all over the place. It was brilliant. And, you know, I think maybe the drugs had something to do with that. But
sounds like it.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? But yeah, I think, I was a very happy chappy, man. And if I ever got annoyed, I think you put it down to the drugs, definitely, because they do have side effects.
So you went to Spain?
Yeah, I did, yeah. Oh, I went, well, mate, I got a buggy boy job. This is a cracking story, right? I mean, this is what dreams come true, innit? Because this is how it all goes down. So there's Kendalshire. I went and joined the Kendalshire for a bit, which is up the road. A new course got designed. Anyway, a couple of the guys there, they like say to me, come on, John, we've got a guy down in Spain, actually. He said, he's a member of a place called Lacalo, or he's associated down there. He said, he could get you a job as a buggy boy. I went, really? Really? Yeah. I said, oh, man, that'd be brilliant. In the winter? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do we get paid? No. But he said, if you go and raise your money, go get a job, raise some money up. We'll help you a little bit. We'll get you down there. He said, you get your board, you get half a car rental, you get your food when you work, and you get unlimited golf. It's like, what? Man, that's a dream job. You know, so anyway, buggy boy, sign me up. Off I went. Met some brilliant people. I mean, Irish turned up, Danish turned up. The Irish, well, Steve Crooks, he's now the head pro at Hollywood Golf Club. Robin Symes, he's coaching the whole of the Korean ladies and men, I think, now at the moment over there. Unbelievable. And then you got Robbie Cannon, who's a fitness instructor, won the Irish Amateur a couple of years back. He was down there doing it as well. So we've all gone our weird little routes, but we all met there when we were kids. And we were totally addicted, playing the par 3 golf course, out on a golf course, playing for a couple of pennies we had in our pocket. And then all of a sudden, this great story, this one person sticks out. His name's Alexander Burhaus. And I haven't spoke to him for a couple of years now. Kind of disappeared off the face of the earth, unfortunately. But back then, I'm on a putting green, having a putting comp, just before going into work. And a guy comes up on a green, says, hey, boys, he just tested the water. He says, anyone want to do some filming for half an hour for 50 quid? All our hands have gone up, like, oh, where? Me. And he's just gone. He's gone to Crooksy first, I think. Crooksy's then gone, well, I got to work. John can do it. So he's passed the roll over to me. Crooksy didn't want it. I've gone, well, I'm quick, really? So anyway, I've gone on to this hole. Cameras there, all rolling. I'm like, what am I, 20, 21, 20, I think. And he's given me these 10 wedge shots. It's all to do with building Santana Golf Club, which was down there, which was on his avocado farm. I didn't know who he was, right? Some German hotshot that was done very well in Wall Street many moons ago, and he's come back and he's got all this. So the camera's rolling, this Spanish guy, lovely guy, I got to give a high five to, hit a few shots in. And anyway, these 10 wedge shots, I all two. Right, so this is weird. So it's 120 yards down the hill, over water, but a green that just faces you with a tier, and the pin is set in a place where you think, oh my God, if you just bring it off that tier, it's going to go in, right? And I just, because I've been playing so well, I had everything on tap, and I could spin it into the hole or just hold it up. And I remember hitting the flag once, lipping out once, and all in 2 out of 10 shots. It was a freak.
Unbelievable. Right?
So The guy comes up to me afterwards. He said, thank you very much for doing that, John. Appreciate that. He said, what are you doing tomorrow? I went, I'm working tomorrow. In the morning, I'll be starting at 5. I said, I'll get finish at about 12, 1 o'clock. He said, can I meet you tomorrow? And I don't know. He had this kind of English accent. I didn't know if he liked me in another way. I just thought, I didn't know. A really unfamiliar territory for me, you know. And then met him at the clubhouse. And he's given me a folder. He said, read it. I would like you to read it. I said, I can't read. He said, I'll read it for you. I said, yeah, please do. So he read it out and it said, right, here's a proposal for you, John. I'd love you to come and live down in Spain. I'm thinking, right, what's the catch? Here we go. And he said, I had a girlfriend at the time. And then he said, you bring her down. Who's your coach? Bring him down. Love to have your mum and dad. He said, I'll find you a place. We'll get you a golf course. And I'll sponsor you for the next 3 years.
Wow.
And it was like, phew. So anyway, with that, I thought, hold on a minute. And for the first time in my life, because I'm a pretty impulsive guy, I said, hold on, I need to make a phone call. Can I make a phone call? He said, take all the time you like. So he let me have his phone. I phoned up George Ryle, my coach, first. Not my mum and dad, because I thought professionally, I got to go to a coach who's been on the European tour. You know, is this legit? You know, because I can move. I'm old enough to, you know. So anyway, so I give him the phone call and he says, well, let me speak to him. So I give him back to Alex and he said, John, that's a real deal, man. He said, unbelievable. He said, I'm on a flight tomorrow. Alex has organised it. I'm coming down. So anyway, then I phone my mum and dad up and tell them what's happening. Oh, be careful, John. You hold on a minute. Ooh, you know what mum and dads are like. We all would be the same. You know, hold on a minute. What does he want? I said, no, he just wants to sponsor me. You sure? Yeah. You've seen it. Yeah. So anyway, where does he live? What does he do? I was like, oh my God, million and one questions. And anyway, at the end of the day, it was all kosher. And I moved down to Spain and started playing a lot. And he would send me to different places to play amateur events, like playing over in Portugal. Never had the money to do that. You know, French amateur, all that, you know, anything. He was like funding it. And I was going to these places and I was able to have a caddy, Louis, my caddy as well, best mate. He came along for a few as well. So amazing, really amazing. And it was just spiraled from there. And then all of a sudden, you know, the whole England thing with, you know, I went to England training camp. I remember it.
Oh my God. Memories are coming back, Rich. Honestly, you know what I'm like as well, but I'm reminiscing now. And this was my last year. This was the moment where I decided to change and turn professional. But yeah, he got a guy who's in the England squad at the time, and we're up at Woodall Spa. And this was the moment, actually. I could go on and on, but if you want to stop me, you stop me.
You go ahead.
Right. So yeah. So it's about second year into being with Alex, and anyway, I got full England training camp. I've earned my stripes to go into the main squad, and you know, Casey and Donald were over in America doing their thing, and Rose was there, and you had like Nick Doherty, and you had David Griffin, you had Graham Storm, you had Richard McAvoy, you had Cole Dyson, you had so many, Wusterholm, I'm forgetting Lowe's Finch, the list goes on. I mean, it was relentless. We had a young kid called David Griffiths, Adam Frey, you name it, there was a load of them. Anyway, it was a concoction of amazing golfers. You know, the only reason Donald and Casey weren't there is because they were over in America. But it was an insane kind of group. Anyway, we went there. I remember I turned up to the England training camp and you had to introduce yourself. So Wusterholm got up and he spoke about himself for 10, 15 minutes and everyone got up and spoke about themselves for 10, 15 minutes. He said, John, so yeah, do you want to introduce yourself? So I stood up. Said, hi, boys and girls. I said, yeah, my name's John Morgan from Somerset. I said, love to be a professional golfer, but I said, my hobbies are dancing and music. Actually, I'll show you some moves now. So I chucked my chair out the side there and I started dancing on the spot in front of all the selectors, chairmen, presidents, all the players. And all the players are like, oh my God, Moggsy's doing it. I'm on my back, I'm doing flips and a spiral and stuff like that. And I get up and I go, da-da, like that. And you can just see all the, you know, the hierarchy going, oh my God, who is this kid? Who is it? John Morgan is here. Okay, fine. So anyway, that was that. And, you know, the mad things we used to do. And I know I'd never get picked for England after one episode, which happened
that night, I think it was, we had a nice little stroke play event between us all. And we went out there and I went to a pub. I didn't drink then, and I just went in there and I had a few games of pool, came out, and as I was coming out, a lovely girl was going in the other way, and I thought, well, she was nice, so I followed her back in. I said, hello, lovely, how you doing? Cool, you're gorgeous. She said, oh, you're not bad yourself. So within 10 minutes, we're walking out of the pub together, you know, and we head off in the car and we have a nice time. We come back, you know, still pretty early, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, maybe. Anyway, turned up, I win it. I beat all of them by miles as well. I played absolutely brilliant. Obviously a little bit lighter in my feet, Rich, as you know, but went round the golf course.
I'm waiting for the punchline here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I went round and I ripped it up and I won it. And I won this lovely cut glass, looked like the claret jug, but in cut glass. And England selector come up to me and he said, John, he said, well played, well played, well done. What did you get up to last night? I said, nothing. Like, just a little white lie. Ah, nothing, mate, went to bed. Not wired. I went, oh, really? He said, yeah, you'll never play for England again, mate. I went, okay, sorry. And that was that. And then within a week, I phoned up my coach straight away on the way back, and he said, you're ready anyway, John. You're ready. You are ready to turn professional. And lucky for me, the EuroPro was just round the corner to go and qualify for the EuroPro because I had no status on anything.
So we should point out, for those that don't know, the EuroPro Tour is kind of like third tier of European golf. And at this point, it just really was in its infancy.
It was. It was beginning. I mean, the Littles had it. Brilliant. I think Barry C, a really good idea, went in there and kind of weaved himself in and out of it and was able to get a tour anyway. I came in and qualified and cool. What a spiral, really. I mean, I got into it and first time really playing for your own money is a weird thing. And you know, we are boxy and a couple of boys, did you play for the money or did you play for your win? It was peculiar because I had no money and I never classed myself as having any money, so I played early doors to break even, or I just wanted to break in. I wanted to be able to pay for the next week, no matter what it was. You know, I didn't want to go broke. I couldn't see myself not playing the next week. So I played so hard just to get that money back into the account so I could play the following week. And, you know, went to Q School, I think it was down at Saunton, got through, cool, absolutely over the moon. And I'm on the EuroPro Tour. And I start like in the top 10, I think, you know, every week for the first, or top five for the first 3 weeks. And I think finishing so high up in the qualifying got me a couple of little invites to the Challenge Tour. And it got me into this one in Germany, and it was co-sanctioned with another tournament, another Challenge Tour tournament. I think it was Saint-Omer or something like that. And it was in Germany, and I remember Alex Checker playing and Marcel Seam. And I finished tied second with Marcel behind Alex Checker. Oh, I was like, wow, whoa. And I'd seen Marcel quite a few in amateur days because when I went to these big tournaments, amateur events, he was there. So I knew Marcel, but I knew he was a strong character, a bit like me, you know, like real go-get-em kind of attitude. Yeah, I'm going to take you out, you know, on the golf course and nice and crazy as pie, you know, off it and stuff like that. So very similar characters. But yeah, and then all of a sudden then my confidence levels just went out of my body a little bit, but I kept myself well within control because my coach was brilliant, Georgie Rowe, mum and dad, like I say, and friends, just kept me grounded.
So we're now going to come to the point which is the almost round for you. So there was a choice really of two, one that we're going to come to on the PGA Tour, and then this event that comes up near home. Mm. I heard, and I don't know if this is right, that you only got into the tournament really late on, like the Wednesday.
Yeah, it was like, on the day before. It's on a Tuesday.
So there was a Challenge Tour event at Bowood.
Yeah, well, Eddie Hearn, who we now know is, you know, running the boxing side of, you know, Matchroom Sport now, he was in contact with me and he was trying to phone me, and I obviously had Alex as well, that had helped me, but I got lost in the fairies if I was totally, you know, it was happening so fast, even then. And then Eddie goes to me, said, John, because supposedly I was supposed to be in this one at Bowood, it was the Charles Church Championship. And it's down the road, and I know the golf course really well. And I obviously got off to a hot start, you know, on the Challenge Tour, because I got a top 10, I got in the next week, and then the next week, and blah, blah, blah. And I just thought, I'm going to win one in a minute. I'm going to win. And I know this course. I fancy my chances. And I remember going out on the golf course. He said to me, he said, John, if I get you in, will you sign with us? I said, I'll do anything. Anything. Just get me in. I need to play. I need to play. So I get this. I'm going down the first fairway. Or the 10th fairway at Clevedon. Then it's the first now. And I've got a second shot in of about 140, 150 yards. I remember it's clear as day. And just before I hit my second shot, my phone goes off. I know you're not supposed to have phones on a golf course, but I was waiting on a phone call. So anyway, I picked it up, the old little Nokia. John, you're in. I was like, oh my God. And I had the ball on tap. It felt like I could spin it any way I wanted into the hole, or I could run it. I could do everything. I always started, you know, Bag of Ants where Randolph Jr. sees lines. All of a sudden, everything goes dark around and he sees this nice white line just to put the ball down. Everything's really clear. That was what it was like. I could see flights, different flights. But I could just add it onto. And I stood over these two wedges after I put the phone down. I said, brilliant. You know, put that down. Phoned up Lewis. Lewis, we're in. Come at the golf club. I'll see you on the back nine. No problem. Phone down. Hit these wedges in. Danced them all around the flag. I was there going, right, I'm having this. So then the next day went up there and let the games begin.
And what a tournament it turned out to be.
Yeah, I mean, when they say a round, near enough the round of your life, I think, you know, that defines you or gets you to a position. Yeah, that was the one.
So it's 30 miles from home.
Yeah.
There's a great photograph of you jumping in the air.
I should have played basketball, shouldn't I?
When you got the win. I mean, you're almost 10 feet up.
Hey, bloody hell. LeBron James, eat your heart out.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you were nearly on cloud nine.
Yeah.
Because this was just your eighth Challenge Tour event. Obviously, you've done really well already. It's in front of friends and family, everyone cheering you on, local boy, and you produced the goods.
It was, yeah, mate, it was surreal because, I mean, David Gill, I'll get his name right. He was living in Germany, English guy. He'd been on the European Tour, or he hadn't been on there a long time, and he posted a ridiculous low round. And he was ahead of me, and I was one from the end. I remember our mate Gary Murphy was playing behind with Greg Hutchins, and they weren't having the best of days. So I had this putt, this 40-footer down the slope over a tier, right to left, but I could see it going in. I mean, George had done his back in. He was walking around the golf course lopsided. You had all local support had come out to see me.
And you had this putt to basically force a playoff.
Force a playoff, and it had to go in. But you know when you have to do it and there is no other option of doing it, how clear things can become, you know, when there is no other option. It was definitely that scenario. Everything became very clear because you're not just laying it up whole side, taking a two putt. No, it's got to go in. It has to be precise. And I must admit, halfway I knew I had it. It didn't even reach the tier yet. And I never even took the slope on the tier to go down onto the thing. And as soon as I started running 5, 6 feet, 7 feet out. I started running. I knew I was having it. And then, yeah, as soon as the thing disappeared, then that's when I took off like Michael Jordan. And McCaddy there looking cool as a cucumber, but everyone in shock around the green, which was brilliant. The only one not shot was me. I was just so passionate. My heart was just beating out of my chest. And I think the camera, they showed us some footage and Dave Gale is like, what can you do? You know, hands up in the air, just like, wow, right, here we go then. So he'd been waiting a long time. And then obviously I was the man in the hot seat, but I was playing with Andrew Sherbourne, who was, you know, like to me, a local legend where I am, won two European Tour events, Spanish and Madrid. And all of a sudden, I'm toe-to-toe with him on final day at this Charles Church Championship, which was like one of the biggest ones because the purse was so big. If you won it, you had your European Tour card sewn up.
So within months, you've gone to EuroPro, to Challenge Tour, to European Tour. Now, for most people, that would be enough, but you weren't done there either, were you?
No. Well, I put that down to Eddie and Barry Earn. You know, Bazza. And Eddie locked heads together. I mean, Barry pretty much said to Eddie, look, you know, take control of John, let, you know, see what you could do. And Barry and Eddie came to the conclusion, like, right, we've got all this time, John, until next season kicks in now, why not have a pop at America? I tell you what, we'll get the entrance fee and you get the journeys. I went, yeah, sweet. Yeah, no problem, let's go and have a go. Roll the dice, isn't it? So anyway, go over there and I remember having a I actually had a seizure in the first round. I actually had a seizure at first stage playing with Ken Duke. Yeah,
during the round.
Yeah, and I didn't know this until I got to tell you honestly about half a year ago. Louis Doe, my caddy at the time, told me I had one on the golf course.
So you have no idea that
I
happened.
Still had no idea it happened, and he said he cozied me in. He actually kind of talked me through the shots, like used my muscle memory. My muscle memory was just all I had. All I had, he said, your brain was shot, John. He said, and you just scabbed it over the line. Like you got in when you were easily making it, you made it by a shot in the end just to get through first stage. But I had a seizure. I didn't know on the golf course.
So you got through the first stage somehow, even yeah, despite
in
the seizure.
Dixon, Tennessee.
Then you got through second stage.
Yeah, second stage. That's a blinder. Orange County National, two great courses. Thought I was cruising, going down the last. Look at Lou. How am I doing? He said, you need to make par. I went, what? I was like double figures under par, thinking this is a really hard track. And yeah, all of a sudden I had to make par, and I did. And I got through the finals.
Where you just hit that ground running.
Well, yeah, you could say yeah. But also, you could, if you'd seen me on the range beforehand, you'd have gone, who is he? How did he get here? But the thing what happened was I was quite lucky because it was based in Palm Springs at PGA West, Nicholas's place. And down the road, there was a skins game going on. Woods, O'Meara, Mickelson, and Couples. How good's that?
Nice.
Right, how good is that? So anyway, we got tickets. Off we go. Whoosh, straight down there. And I've hit it, honestly, I'm like the red arrows on the practice ground. And with that, we're on the final hole, final tee box of them playing, right? I think it was the time when Steve Williams chucked the camera into the lake that time. So it was that particular one, but we missed it. Because what I told the boys, I said, I need to go back to the range. It was like half an hour of daylight left. I said, I need to do something because the rain's starting, you know, the next day. I went out there and I said, I've got it, boys. Went to the range, first swing, got it. Only needed to hit one. Just I had this thinking in my head about what I was seeing and how good it made me feel. I was so pumped. I went to the range and I just copied, you know, a bit of everyone that I was just seeing. And I just went, I got it. Well, coach didn't even have to do anything.
You turned into Tiger Mickelson.
I turned into all of them. I was relaxed like Couples, you know, in a sense as nothing was riling me. I had good rhythm, you know, like O'Meara. I felt like I had good rhythm like O'Meara. I had the flair and chips like Mickelson that week. And I felt solid and strong as a rock, like you see Tiger over a ball. And I felt like that. Oh wait, I had accumulation of all four enrolled into one. And I tell you what, I got on the golf course and I just couldn't do anything wrong. You know, I mean, the world's nearly came off at the end. I plugged a ball in a sleeper. How do you plug a ball in a sleeper? Which, you know, obviously made me heart jump out because we couldn't find it for a while until someone seen a little bit of white. And I think that was like three holes from the end. Then Alcatraz, 17, made it over by half a yard, two putted, got away with that. And then I could make a 10 up the last and still get my card. Instead, I just played up the right away from the water and came away with a bogey and said, get me out of here, I got my card, thank you very much.
So when your coach told you, what, 7-8 months earlier, you're ready to turn pro, my God, was he right.
Cool.
Euro Pro, Challenge Tour, European Tour, now PGA Tour card.
Yeah, I know, crazy. And then it's like, well, what do you do? Which one do you want to play on? You know, it's like, sport for choice.
What a nice dilemma.
Cool, yeah. Richard, unbelievable, bud. When you look back, it was a whirlwind.
So you chose America?
Chose America. Sponsorship-wise, was massive. You know, I mean, it was totally different. You know, you had Europe, but you were talking seven times difference, I suppose. You know, big markup back then, you know, and then Nike, Callaway came along, fought for me, went with Nike in the end. Don't know if it was necessary the right decision because I was already playing Callaway. But they were the same price, and I chose that. I think probably the Tiger aspect of him being Nike kind of swayed me a little bit towards it. But, you know, end of the day, I went with Nike.
You went with Nike, dyed your hair blue. That was a bet, wasn't it?
That was a bet by Les Garland. I based myself in Miami. As soon as I got my card, the German guy, Alex Burhaus, he used to went to uni there. He said, I'll sort your digs out, John. Don't you worry. So anyway, he gave me a suite on the 16th floor on the tip of Ocean Drive in South Beach. Now, a man who's single and loves life and the beach and the sun and music. I was like, you could have put me in a more secluded area to keep me away from this. But no, you put me straight in the middle of, well, you know, of a place that I would really enjoy.
Dreamland, anyway. Basically.
Dreamland, I mean, it was paradise, you know, palm trees and lovely kind of, you know, just open plan, and golf courses were immense down there. Le Gorse was a place I played, which was amazing. You had Doral down the road as well, which was beautiful. But yeah, I mean, Les Garland, the first two guys I met, was a 6'10" black dude with an afro called Keith Askins. He's the defensive coach for the Miami Heat. And then the other guy was Les Garland, co-founder of MTV. Unbelievable. I turn up, the head pro says to me, he said, I'm with George, my coach. And he said, I think they're out on the second. Go and meet up with these two. He said, they'd like to play with you. Anyway, I've only played with him for about half a hole and I go into a seizure. Again, I'm on a buggy. I'm headed straight towards a lake, driving this buggy, right? So George has had to grab the wheel, pull it away from the lake. We don't go in, luckily. But he comes up, gets me in the passenger, comes up along Les and Keith and says, sorry, John's just had a little turn. He said, give him a minute. I said, he'll come back around. Anyway, after that, for the next 10, 11 holes, I think I had 7 or 8 birdies. Flew it, and I can't remember one shot. Can't remember one shot. And Les and Keith then, I started playing golf with them all the time. Les would invite me around his house for a barbecue with him and his good lady and dog, and he showed me all his memorabilia on the wall when he was, you know, hanging around with the Beatles or the Rolling Stones and, yeah, unbelievable stuff. You know, him and Eddie Murphy on a show on David Letterman and stuff like that. I was going, who is this guy? Wow. You know, it was like the first celeb I've ever seen, you know, met. You know, after that, then we just used to have funky bets on the golf course. And obviously then I lost one, didn't I? Yeah, I used to give him a lot of 6-7 footers. It's my fault, really.
But you got you noticed on the PGA Tour, that's for sure. And that summer, you finished, I think, 5th twice on the PGA Tour. I mean, it was a decent rookie season, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was Greensboro. It was weird because my best mate, Louis, got a little bit homesick. We had half a year out there, and it was hectic. We were here, there, and everywhere, a lot of journeying. And Louis, fair play to him. He was a great caddy, and things were about to happen, but, you know, he just wanted to go home, and I could understand that. Porter's Head is a lovely place to live, and totally get it, you know, and he's got a big family and nice people around him. So he left, and then Cliff came in. Cliff Picking, who's caddied for many, like, you know, Philip Price in the Ryder Cup when he beat Mickelson. He come over, and Greensboro. Yeah, there was a 5th place there, which was a massive tournament. Big one near the end of the season. That was a good one, making birdie up the last. BC Open, I think, was the other one. And lovely little golf course, which they don't play anymore. It was good. It just gave me an appetite for it, really.
And, it all, you know, justified, because I'm sure some people are questioning whether you should have, you know, tried the Europe, because you hadn't, at this point, even played a European Tour event. So I wouldn't say you've cracked it on the PGA Tour, but you've proved that you're up for that standard.
Well, yeah, I suppose you're right. But I think hindsight, if I look back, I would have probably been, I'd have probably stayed more grounded and close to home and kept my bearings a little bit easier if I'd have stayed in Europe, because, you know, South Beach is pretty wild.
I know, but what a...
I know, I know.
Experience.
I just lived the dream, mate, for a bit. I must admit, I just, you know, when I speak to my mates, they say, well, at least you've done it, John. You might have squandered whatever you did, but, you know, you had a good time. I said, yeah, I did. And, you know, I'm thankful for it. You know, very thankful.
Let's move to the next year and to the round.
Yeah.
So the week before the Open, the PGA Tour has the John Deere Classic. And obviously, with it being the week of the Open, it's not the strongest field. Vijay Singh's there. He's the defending champion.
And he was world number one. Yeah. Overtook Tiger that year, didn't he? Won 10 times, mate. Phew.
And you knew him pretty well.
I was starting to play a lot of golf with Vijay. Yeah, a lot of golf. Played with him earlier that year in Pebble Beach. Got trained with his trainer at the time, Joey. And amazing how the top golfers in the world, though, this is where, you know, Vijay and Tiger really changed the face of golf, because, like Tiger said, the only one that was doing training as hard as him was Vijay, and he was the only one to overtake him when he was in his prime. Vijay, no surprise there, is there? So, you know, I remember playing at Pebble just before we get into the round. You know, Joey said, I'll train you. Vijay said, I'd like to, you wouldn't mind being trained. I said, that'd be great. He said, right, I'll see you in the gym at 5. You're teeing off at 9. I went, you want me in the gym at 5 in the morning? He said, yeah, but Vijay's off at 8 o'clock and he's in the gym at 4 o'clock in the morning. I went, wow, is this how it goes down? Is this, you know, is this if you want to be elite, this is what it is? And, you know, when I turned up at 5 and can see Vijay's just walking out, and I can see Mickelson hitting the pads with Bones at like quarter to five in the morning. And they go, wow, this is different. You know, and yeah, proper wake-up call.
Was it Vijay that recommended using the belly putter?
I just watched him and I just thought from 8-10 foot out, I felt like it was hardly, you were never going to miss. You know, I mean, yeah, I totally agree. Anchoring is not the way to go, but I couldn't touch the hole from a foot. You know, I came back and all of a sudden the pressure was mounting and all of a sudden I need to release some kind of pressure from my game, and that was it, really. That was my get-out clause, was the belly putter. I mean, I use the claw now and it's absolutely fine. You know, don't flinch a muscle, but, you know, it's out of my system. But at the time, never experienced the yips, and I got a little bit of it then on my putting, and the belly putter helped me out, yeah.
So you're using this method when we get to the John Deere Classic. And played first 3 days, you shot 66, 69, 68. Jose Caceres is leading.
Yeah.
Well, you haven't won yet on the PGA Tour, but are you feeling that this is a chance coming up?
Definitely. I mean, I got to say, the nice thing was, and the first time that had ever happened, the German turned up, Alex Berghaus, my old sponsor, turned up that week. First time since I had my US Tour card and got it. He's finally turned up and he's followed me the whole way round. He's my guardian angel, really. Yeah. I mean, where he came from. But anyway, he followed me until he had to leave on the 9th green of the last round. So I'm like 2 under, I think I was, through, you know, the first 9 holes. And then he's got to leave, so I give him a big hug and say, it's been great seeing you. And then off I go on to the back 9 on the final day.
Almost like on that, he got that hug, he gave you some special power because you went mental.
I went absolutely crazy, mate. It all started, you know. I remember a slick downhiller, left to right on 10 on the par 5. You know, it's a Deer Run is a great golf course. It's well manicured. Obviously, the John Deere, all the tractors and combine harvesters that they do, and grass cutters and rollers. I mean, they're going to have a spick and span golf course, and my God, it's a beauty. I mean, boys, rip it. There's a lot of birdie chances out there because it's in such great condition. You know what I mean? It is mint. And what is it? You know, the slick down inner, left to right from about 6 foot it was, for birdie on 10, started the ball rolling, really, and then just started seeing arrows.
Because you were 5 behind with 9 holes to play.
I know.
And you end up in a playoff. But there you are. Remember Bo Wood, the 40-footer you had to hole to get into a playoff. And deja vu, we're at it again.
We are.
18th green, you've got, again, a fairly lengthy one. Not quite as long as the one at Bo Wood, but a lengthy one nonetheless to get yourself in a playoff on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, well, it kind of started. The buzz and the crowd got behind me on about 13, 14, 15. Because I started fist pumping pretty early. And I, you know, 15 is a really tough par 4. Pin was left. I've hit this tall tower in 4-iron. I never shied away from any flag because I thought my short game was too strong. So I thought I'd keep going at the flags. And they kept coming off, coming in, nice high ball fight, landed soft, all in a putt. Came to 16, nice little par 3, made a putt up the hill from right to left. 17, had it hanging on the lip for birdie again, and come to 18. Well, yeah, good drive down the left-hand side of the fairway, ripped my little known, you know, big draw that I had up the green and started running it up towards the flag. Water on the left-hand side, as we all know, 18 at the John Deere is... It's a cracking hole, and it doesn't suit my eye off the tee because it's a left-to-right tee shot. And I was a vigorous right-to-left. Don't mean a thing if you ain't got that sling. You know, and me and Nicholas Kolsarts over the years, when we grew up, used to take the mickey out of my big sling, but, you know, he didn't mind it. He could do it also. He could do it anyway. But this was my chance, and, I took it, you know, and I didn't know what was going on behind. Hensby was behind me with Caceres, and... Yeah, I mean, you have those moments. Again, it was exactly like Bo Wood, where you know it has to go in. It has to go in. There is no other way. And it was a 20-footer, slightly uphill, and a minuscule drift from right to left. I mean, it was a hard read. But the thing is, when you know you got to do it, it comes across an easy read because you just see it straight away. I mean, my caddy, Nick was on my back, Nick Lane, and top man, being a great friend for so long. He was on the bag and he just left me to my own devices because he could see my eyes were glazed and ready to go and they were focused and they were determined. Fire was boiling. I wanted to go crazy for the crowd. because the crowd were on tippy toes. I had this lady going around me and she was going bananas. She was about in her 60s. I thought she was going to pass out. I really did. And she's going absolutely potty. She's shaking and rolling. She's weird, you know, reeling me on. Everyone's reeling me on. And then I came down there and it was like the crowd is like on the edge of its feet going, please hold it because we want to lose the plot. We want to chuck our bottles on the green. We want to dive in the lake. It felt like they all wanted to lose it with me. And then obviously halfway I knew it was going in. So I've just started bloody fist pumping like a good one. And they're all going absolutely apeshit, Rich. And I got to say it was a brilliant moment, a moment where I wish I could relive again. You never can, but you can kind of get little bits and bobs back or see a little rerun of something. But amazing, mate. And the warming of the crowd was unbelievable. I made a lot of good friends that week. I haven't been back for a long time, but I made a lot of good friends.
You fed off the crowd, they fed off you.
Oh, yeah.
You were just in that zone, and I was watching at the time, I remember as well. I've watched it back since as well. Mm. And it is your reaction. I mean, there's nothing forced with it, it's just a natural elation and joy that you've
but
had.
But how
that
good
part.
Is it? I mean, whoever's listening here now, I mean, when you get the great vibes or you know, given to you, positivity from whoever it is, if it's done with masses or just one person, you're gonna feel great. Someone's bigging you up, and this. The crowd were bigging me up. And, you know, it was like, well, I'm going to deliver for you, boys. We're going to go bananas now. Here we go. And I rolled the putt and they went, you know, crazy. They started dancing.
So what went wrong in the playoff?
Me, do you know what? A final realisation of where I was. And that is absolutely it in a nutshell. I went to the range and I was sat down with Hank Keeney, actually. You know, the big hitter back then. And Nick, and we were hitting some balls, and it was fine. A bit too relaxed, probably. You know, I was still kind of in the hunt, and I'd heard Hensby had did it in the trees twice up 17. It come back out on the fairway and got away with a par, and then I heard he was in the bunker up 18, and you know, it was like dead on that right hand side. No green to work with, fast and slick down towards the water. The one actually, Jordan Spieth, hold it out from, you know, and it was that same bunker, but the pin was further down the green, so he had less green to work, more green to work with, but it was faster. Anyway, he gets up and down, it sits to like a foot, right? We're going to playoff, you know, and it was nice to be in that position. I mean, we went back down 18, man, we tied it, we drove it in the bunker on the left, hit a big rake and draw, got it on the front right of the green, big putt, you know, hit it about 6-7 foot past, hold it coming back, you know, fist pump again, keep the dream alive, and came over to 16, this quirky little par three. You know, which I birdied in regulation play, but yeah, this time I set my feet up at the same target I did before, back right bunker on the left edge of it, think I'll play my natural draw, keep it below the hole, 15, 20, you know, 10, 15 foot, I'll hole it, you know, but then in my mind just turned to the flag, but my body didn't, so I'm still aiming right, but now my shoulders have turned to the flag and my head, everything, my whole demeanor is at the flag, so I've pulled it online, so my natural draw and the pull made the ball go further left. Then I'm in the hazard, and really and honestly, with hardly any stance whatsoever, I was having to aim 45 degrees away from the flag, hooding my club, trying to bend my hands back and play this little kind of like try and get some kind of connection anyway, skull it over the green in the bunker, and then play a bunker shot out, which hit the lip of the hole, nearly went in.
It looked in, didn't it? About three, four feet out.
Mate, it was cool. Yeah, it was tracking, but it was going at speed. I thought if it is the fly, it's going to have to hit it plumb. But as soon as it started to turn, I thought, well, it's not going to stick now. You know, I could see from it was just going on the left edge, but it hit the left edge pretty firm. Yeah, it was close, mate. But nice though. Give it a nice wave. You know, had a good time.
What an experience. Good. And £465,000 richer. I mean, I know you wanted to win. Obviously, you did.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, we've talked about where you've come from, your upbringing. I mean, to anyone, that's a lot of money. But from, you know, these are life-changing amounts, aren't they? I mean,
yeah.
$500,000 in 1 week.
Oh, yeah. Well, I put it to good use. Paid off my mum and dad's mortgage and just made sure everyone was fine and dandy.
How lovely was that?
Yeah, it was brilliant. But, you know, I mean, I think any son or daughter in that position that are grateful of what people have done for them in the past will definitely give back. If they've got it to give back, sometimes they're not fortunate to do it, but if you get the chance, you will do it because you feel brilliant. And, you know, I had just really, really lucky. great parents, and they put their lives on the line and financials on the line just to get me to a certain place in golf. I remember, you know, put it this way, you know, put me and my dad at the British Amateur at Hoylake. Remember this vividly. My dad didn't have a penny, and he's working on the docks. Hard as things are, we're there. We slept in the car the whole week. I lost in the quarterfinals. I nearly got to the Masters, but we were sleeping in the car the whole week with an old duvet or a rag over our you know, bodies, you know, waterproofs over our bodies in this little Ford Escort in the car park at Hoylake. Waking up every morning, go and clean our teeth in the clubhouse, and off to the tee we went. Nearly won it. And that's how you do it. You know, it's, and then when I look back, I just feel so grateful, mate. I was able to walk and live and breathe it and feel it. And yeah, thanks to them. Classic.
Yeah, amazing. And there was almost another present that week as well. The Open Championship.
Oh, yeah, well.
Were you told that you were in the Open?
Well, Hensby, you win that, you obviously get in the Open. So Hensby, you know, he got in, but he was having family issues at the time. I think he was going for a breakup or whatever was going on, I don't know. But the poor man decided, look, I can't do it, my head's a little bit screwed. He said, you're more than welcome to have my spot, John. I was like, what, really? It's like, yeah, right, yeah, man, game on. And really and honestly, the form I was in, I was thinking, right, this is a good time. I love links. I hit a low draw. I was like, made for me, man. I could chip. You know, I didn't fear any bunkers if I was up against the face. I thought, oh, yeah, my putting was up. I was like, yeah, I'm game, yeah. And unfortunately, one of the R&I guys phoned me up quickly before I went in the press conference and said, sorry, John, we can't give it to you. It's got to go back to the winner. It has to only go to the winner or it goes back in the pot. And I went, I totally understand. He said, I'm sorry. I said, no need. I said, one day, hopefully, I'll get in it anyway on merit. It never happened in the end. I never got to play a major. I think I missed out 4 times by a shot. It's amazing, really, never to play one when quite a few of the people that I know have played them. But, you know, what was about to happen after that, you know?
Well, yeah, well, we'll come to that. So, BC Open, you do pretty well.
Yeah.
Just outside the top 10. And how are you lifestyle here? Because you mentioned, you know, where you're living. Now you're earning a load of money. I mean, was it going crazy?
It was. And, you know, I was celebrating a little bit. I would say I was a little bit out with the fairies, which is not anything different, Rich, as you well know. But, I mean, you know, I was having a nice time. And I remember Les Garland was over the moon, and this is the MTV guy, he was over the moon. He had a house up in Link, Missouri, I think it was. He said, oh, come along, we'll do some fishing and play some golf. And I went, yeah, great, cool. So I did that for only like 2-3 days. And I was really excited because I was going to go and see my mum and dad. They were going to the Lake Tahoe Open and in Reno. I haven't seen them in ages, and they've been over the moon, seen all my exploits on TV, been phoning them all the time. Skype had just come around then, and so we were Skyping a lot, and my mum's having a Betsy. My dad dyed his moustache blue. Right, mate, it's hilarious, and he looks like Sean Connery with a blue moustache. It's so funny, right? And then my mum, she had like blue streaks in her hair as well. I was like, yeah, go for it, mum. Right, they were just absolutely loving it. And then it just happened. I mean, I had to go via Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. And got on a plane and met a few caddies and players actually on the plane on their way to Reno, because it was that time of the, you know, week where everyone seems to travel to that kind of location to play. And obviously, big event. And got in my chair. And the only thing I do remember is actually getting in my chair. Then the rest of it, you know, after that really was a proper mind blank. I woke up in hospital. So, you know, I remember the engine starting up. I really remember the engine starting up. And when I mean starting up, I mean starting on to take off, not just coming out of its taxi service to get to the position to take off. We are actually going down a runway. And then all of a sudden I wake up in hospital. And I got to be honest with you, I thought, did we have a plane crash? What happened? You know, I don't know what happened. I thought, have I survived it? And then I looked down the bottom of my bed as I've come to in my bed, and I see a guy called Rick Goyette, who became a caddy afterwards from Boston, and he got off the plane, a caddy, to help me out. Thank to him, because then he made all the phone calls. He took my phone, phoned my mum and dad, made sure I was all right, phoned Eddie, you know, like, couldn't get hold of my mum and dad, but Eddie had the number to get hold of my mum and dad. So Eddie had to make a load of phone calls and phoned up my mum and said, everything will be all right, we'll get him to you. Eddie then got on a flight. He travelled over. He got there before me because I obviously been a night over in Dallas sleeping in hospital. But, you know, I did a proper number on myself. I bit my tongue off, rotated a little bit of my sternum bone, they said. I cracked a couple of ribs, two disc heads at the top of my back, and pulled both my groin muscles. But because all what happened was there was a caddy in front of me on the chair, and he said all of a sudden I was banging on the back of his chair. And he said, oh, come on, John, stop it, mate. And then he turned around, he could see me going into one, proper full-blown seizure. And it went on a really long time. So what happened is the plane has started up and it's on its way down there. Someone's at the emergency. The baby's come to a halt. The bird's come to a halt. Ambulance has come out because it's a longer time for the plane to taxi in. So they sent the ambulance out onto the runway, stretched me off the plane that way on the runway itself. So I shut down Dallas Airport, I think, for about 15, 20 minutes or something like that.
I mean, horrific injuries, your seatbelt.
Oh, I snapped it. I was in the splits. I can't even get any close to the splits, Rich. But by all accounts, I was in the split position, wedged in between the three seats in front of me and the seats I was already in.
Now, what I don't understand is you went back playing golf.
Yeah, I know. Silly sausage. Did a lot more harm than what you should do, really. I mean,
because, I mean, you mentioned all the injuries you had. I mean, first of all, how were you able to play golf?
Well, mate, it was something I should never have done. I got to the golf course and I went to Health South. A bit like, you know, on the European Tour, they got your kind of health, you know, and fitness kind of thing. They had their one called Health South. And went in there and they mended me like crazy. They were jamming the disc heads at the top of my back. They were working on the pulled muscles around my rib cage and the ribs and stuff like that, helping me with my sternum, all the bruising and the trauma that had gone in there. The tongue had gone into a big, you know, ulcer by then because it'd been fixed at the hospital. So that was just one big ulcer. So I was like slurring my words. But they gave me a boatload of morphine, these sticks. They were like lollipops. They were amazing. Honestly, they were amazing. I mean, eyes a kite when you know you whack them in, you suck on it for 5 minutes, and you're seeing Jimi Hendrix and everyone else, you know, enjoying themselves. So, you know, obviously that was great, but put me in a really false sense, because after that I felt like I could swing it. My brain was still wired to the moon, thinking I could still play because I've come off such a hot streak. This is where I'm, you know, I really should have listened to, well, probably my mum and dad. But you had good golfers in the wing at first reserve, and you know, I stand up on the first tee, high as a kite on morphine, you know, strapped up around my body, absolutely anything, take a swing, I could only hit it 100 yards.
Is this literally the week out? I mean, how long before you've come out of hospital to playing?
Two days.
That's so crazy. Because you said Eddie was there and people, were they not screaming at you?
Yeah, well, I was, you know, being a stubborn git. You know, I wasn't listening to anyone. I was listening to my mind. My mind was saying, you can do this. It was like heart, you know, mind over matter. It was like, I just thought, I'll beat this. And then for the next couple of weeks, I tried playing, keep playing. I did myself more injury. You know, and
yeah, every tournament says WD, withdrawn. Withdrawn. You started but never finished.
Never. Couldn't even get close, mate. I remember playing with great incidents. I was trying to recover and I thought I was getting back to it. And I got in late to Deutsche Bank, I think it was, in Boston. I played with Zach Johnson and Davis Love III. Got in late, so they were my pairing. But, you know, just before it, I give like Donald Trump, I didn't know who he was, Trumpy. I didn't have an absolute Scooby-Doo, he was, in just my caddy at the time goes, you're a silly sausage. Why? He said, yeah, I got a clue who that is. I said, no, it's Trumpy. He said, but that's Donald Trump. I said, who's Donald Trump? He said, just go online and have a look, John, and you'll see. Anyway, I give him a lesson, and I said, just copy what I do, Trumpy. Trying to make him feel relaxed, because I think he was going out in a pro-am with Tiger that day. So anyway, done all that. And then, went out on a golf course, and I think I just played a couple of holes with him, and I couldn't get past it. I was only good round the greens. but come to a full swing where, you know, you're using your upper body a lot more, and, you know, your stresses and your power and everything trying to be explosive, and it just wasn't there. I couldn't have it.
So instead of getting a medical, waiting till you're fit, coming back and earning the what you needed, something like $20,000 to keep your card, you ended up being the beginning of the end of that road.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was. I remember it clearly, actually, Rich, because the following year, went back in 05 to Q School. Remember getting a nice little phone call from Richard Johnson and Jesper Parnevik, actually, and Pell-Jurt Johansson, because they were really nice. And I was going down. You had Eric, who did all the travel arrangements and helped people with accommodation stuff for the US tour, and he was down in Palm Beach. And on my way down, he said, "Call by, John, we need a chat." And I think they knew I was on my way home. I wanted to go home. I was homesick, I needed mum and dad, and just needed to be around friends and family. And he called me in anyway. I had a nice night with him, had a few chats. They were trying to keep me staying in America. But I wasn't having anything of it, my mind was set. So I came back, really, and that was it.
And you kind of took a sabbatical.
Yeah, I just disappeared
for
a bit.
About a year?
Yeah, get my head around. I mean, I wanted to change my drugs as well. The drugs hadn't worked. You know, I was on a different drug then, called Lamictal. Lamotrigine is its main name. That was the new drug I was on. And obviously, after having that attack, I had to question what I was taking and stuff. So I wanted to go to the doctors. And, you know, I wasn't driving. I hadn't driven for like 7-8 years. So with that, I've come back. Found a new drug called Keppra, which nickname is Keppra Rage. So, you know, it's supposed to make you angry, but I was pretty relaxed guy, so luckily it didn't really affect me that much. But what a wonder drug that's been for me. I mean, totally give me another life.
You still on that?
Still on that, and I tell you what, I haven't had one, touch wood, since. So, yeah, I got to thank my lucky stars. I've been back driving. Brain damage is still there at the front and in the right side. I mean, that's not going to leave. Hopefully it's just not getting bigger. I've got to go for checkups again. But, yeah, I mean, it's been interesting.
Yeah.
Well, got my European Tour card back for a season, which was nice.
Well, you had to finish top three in the final event on the Challenge Tour season.
Yeah.
And there you go. Need to do it. You do it again.
Yeah, I shot a 10-under that week as well in a blowing hooli in San Domenico, it was, in Italy. Played with Rafa Cabrera Bello. Richard Bland and Tano Goya. He was the man who pit me at the post to win it. I did it into about a half a yard, you know, foot and a half from the pin. He hit it to 6 inches on the last. He said, "No, I'm having it." I went, "All right, fair enough."
But second was good enough anyway.
Second for it was good enough, but then I was back on the European Tour, which was lovely.
So you and got to play the European Tour eventually.
Again, yeah. Finally got to play a full card, you could say, yeah, which was lovely. I mean, I didn't really have much success, I've got to be honest. I'm still a little bit, don't know, wasn't my full self out there.
I watch you play now. I mean, you are such a natural, talented golfer. You watch you, and I watch other players watching you as well. You've still got that talent.
Well, I know
you're listening, and you're great at the commentating. I know you love doing that as well, but is there something inside of you that thinks, I'm as good as these guys?
Oh, do you know what? I look at them and I see them strike it, and I see the game has completely changed now, Rich.
I know,
it's completely changed, but in a sense of...
But you can hit it as far as them.
You've
still got that totally game around the greens.
Yeah, even though Spencey's 3-3 at the moment, which I'm a bit gutted, but I will have my own back. He's just got lucky at the moment. But I would say I can mix it. I played a pro-am at Belgium, knockout, which was awesome. Played with Callum Shingun there, and I had an eagle and like 4 or 5 birdies as well on the way round. And, you know, I see Nicholas Coulthard, I'm good friends with both of him and Thomas Peters and Marcel. And, I hit shots with them on the range sometimes and, get the bug. And they see me hit it and they go, "I haven't changed." I mean, Thomas last year in Portugal, he's on the range and it's pro-am day. And he said, "John, Nicholas said you would hit this drive." He said, "You haven't even warmed up yet." He said, "You would just grab it and stonk it straight down the middle." I went, "Give it here." And I ripped his driver. And it ain't easy to hit Thomas's driver because it's, you know, he's a big dude, isn't he?
We're talking strong. Thomas Peters.
Thomas Peters, right? So, you know, we know he can crunch it. And that club ain't made for me. But I had to pretend I was Thomas Peters, so I stayed really tall, felt really strong, put my chest out, felt like I'd imitate his golf swing, like a bit of a robot looking, you know, strike, and murdered it straight down the middle. He said, Coulthard said you'd do that. He said, fair play.
And so maybe when you're 50?
Yeah, I mean, Eddie Hearn, Barry Hearn, they're interested again. Eddie said to me, he said, you're keeping your body nice and calm, John. You might be putting on a bit of weight, but you can easily take it off. He said, maybe you have a think of seniors. I said, well, we'll cross that bridge when it comes to it. But I really love the commentary. I love being out there on the golf course. Yeah, I miss hitting a couple of the shots. The pressure's, I don't think the pressure really agree with me, if I'm totally honest. Rich, I think that's probably where I came undone with regarding the epilepsy.
Oh, with the epilepsy. Because I was going to say, because when the pressure was really on,
I loved it.
You delivered.
I loved it. But the thing is, I think the epilepsy, because the brain, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. And they say as soon as your heart rate goes above 120, you know, electrons start firing in your brain. And where I've got my black matter in my brain, if that gets, you know, starts becoming alive, then I'm ready to have a seizure. And many times I've walked off a golf course in really good conditions. I mean, there's been many more when this is the reason I packed in. So after I got my European Tour card back in, what was that, 2010 when it, or 2011, was it?
2009,
sorry. Man, yeah. Crikey. Wish my life away. But no, I went back and I had a go at the Challenge Tour. And I remember getting in good positions. Rolex in Switzerland was leading. And I had to walk off the golf course. I had a seizure. What was it? Went to the Italian Open, got off to a hard start, couple of under after the first few holes, second round or summit, looking like I'm well on my way. I have a seizure on the green. I actually end up putting the ball back into the lake. I had a 20 footer up the hill and I put my putter around the other way and I knocked it backwards into the lake. Don't know what I'm doing. Then I went to a Challenge Tour event in Ireland and I remember Crooksy, the head pro at Hollywood, caddying for me and I'm winning it by a streak. I've gone out in, we come to an eighth hole, par five, and I've hit the shot up by the green. I've got a little chip in for an eagle, and I'm already five under par for my round. This to go to seven under through eight, you know, I'm definitely going to be six. Anyway, I've had a seizure over the ball, picked my ball up. He shouted at me, drop it. So I dropped it in mid-flight, goes down to the ground, and got a clue what I'm doing. I end up making eight from the side of the green for an easy little chip in eagle. Then I make double up the next, and I make a double up the next. Don't know where I am. And I'm walking up, I had another one, three holes later. And then he dragged me in. And then it happened again. The final straw was in second stage, Q school. Went back to second stage, I had to go back there. Shot 59 in the practice round with Scott Henderson and Stuart Davis. Shot 59 in a practice round. And then still on the first tee, with I got Benny Ann's caddy on my bag, Dan Parrott, and I had a seizure right on the tee, and Dan's just gone, we're off, mate.
And that was that?
That was that, and after that, I never hit a ball again.
I mean,
in tournament play, really, yeah.
What a story, John.
Oh, it'd be mental. But good, though. I mean, keep smiling, I'm still here, ain't I? So, still here. Love life, mate.
Well, there you go. I mean, hopefully now you know all about John Morgan. Whenever I'm with John and in his company, and normally within a working capacity, you always come away with a smile on your face, and hopefully you've kind of, even though there's a lot of sadness in that story, hopefully you've come away with a smile on your face as well. He's a genuine, funny, lovely, kind-hearted man, obviously someone who was an extremely talented golfer, who's a very good broadcaster as well. I'd love to know what you think. Let me know at The Round Podcast on Twitter, at The Round Golf Podcast on Facebook as well. Really love your thoughts on John Morgan and all the episodes as well we've had in the series, but particularly obviously given what we just listened to John. Obviously want to thank our sponsors Red Ray and Navigate Contracting for their help in this series. Thanks to you as well for listening. And if you enjoyed what you heard just now, and I have a feeling you did, please tell someone about it, because especially someone like John Morgan's story, I'd love as many people as possible to know it's out there. And also one way of doing that is by giving us a terrific rating on iTunes as well. But that's all for now. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to The Round with Richard Kaufman. You can follow us and get in touch via Twitter at The Round Podcast, on Instagram, Podcast The Round, and on Facebook at The Round Richard Kaufman.
and we'd appreciate you taking the time to rate and review us on iTunes. The Round Podcast with Richard Kaufman, in association with IMG Audio.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.